Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Talking OTC Commodities. My name is Richard Heath. This week we've travelled to the offices of Simpson Spence Young in London. Simpson Spence Young are a global shipbroker with a strong research and derivatives business, and I'm very happy to be joined today by Duncan Dunn from SSY Futures, Derek Langston, Head of Research for SSY, and Philip Tripodakis from the LNG Shipbroking Desk. In this episode, we're going to discuss IMO 2020, the impact this is having on the shipping market today, and also how this is affecting the linked derivative markets for dry and wet freight. In addition, we're going to discuss potential new fuel sources for the shipping market and also potential new products in freight derivatives such as LNG FFAs. So, perhaps we can start with a bit of scene setting. There's been a huge amount of discussion about IMO 2020 over the last, 5 years at least, but definitely over the last few years. And now we're just 2 months away from implementation. It would be really great to understand what you guys as a broker see happening in the physical market as a result of this new regulation.
Hi, Richard. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It has been a lot of talking about IMO 2020, and now we're certainly feeling the effects of this, in particular in the dry bulk freight market. The market has had a sustained upward push from the middle of 2019, and a lot of this, in our view, can be traced to developments and preparations relating to the IMO 2020 deadline from the 1st of January next year. There are a number of ways that this has affected the market, so I'd like to talk just quickly about some of them. Firstly, there's the impact on fleet inefficiency. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're preparing as a ship owner, you're preparing to be compliant with the new global limit of 0.5% sulfur from 3.5%, there are a number of ways you can do this. You could opt for a compliant fuel, one already produced that is 0.5% sulfur or below. Or you could take the step of actually installing an exhaust gas cleaning system, also known as a scrubber, on board. And I could say that this adoption of scrubbers does, of course, mean that vessels will be taken off hire for a number of weeks to have the work done. And, of course, taking vessels out of the market naturally is supportive. And we've observed this, an upturn in the vessels being taken off from the second quarter of this year through the third quarter. And adopting scrubbers would make more sense, given the capital expenditure, makes more sense for the higher value vessels, where you can make your payback period shorter, anticipated higher earnings. So it would make more sense for larger vessels. So in the dry bulk market, this is predominantly Capesizes, over 100,000 deadweight, and Panamaxes as well, say 65,000 to 99,000 deadweight, and to a lesser extent, smaller vessels of below 65,000 deadweight. So what we've seen really on the Capesize market, which has had quite a pronounced upward push, is that we've seen about, say, fairly kind of steady kind of numbers between 50 and 60 Capes taken into dry dock in Chinese yards for scrubber fitting. This is, in terms of the dynamic in the Capesize market, this has, of course, kept tonnage not only off hire, but focused in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And for the Capesize market, A lot of the dynamism and the higher earnings comes from front haul voyages from the Atlantic carrying cargo into the Pacific. So by keeping the vessels tied up off market or trading within the Pacific, you are thinning out the flow of ballasters into the Atlantic so that when cargo does become available on the spot market, you get an upward push, a bit of a squeeze on rates, and they start to spiral upwards. So that's been one very obvious effect. And tied to this, we're actually observing in some cases slightly longer scrubber fitting times. You can also see a few examples of vessels waiting to enter dry dock. And that, of course, is bad for fleet efficiency and helps tighten those supply-demand balances. So that would be one very obvious effect that we've observed. What we do think in terms of the... At SSY Research, we spend a lot of time tracking the fleet, and we believe that currently we are on course to see around 20 to 25% of the Capesize fleet being scrubber fitted by March of next year. For Panamaxes, we would estimate we were on course to see up to 10%, and then for the smaller geared vessels, less than 5%. This, of course, means there's a mass migration to lower sulfur fuels. Mm-hmm. And this is the second part in terms of the tightening in the market, in terms of fleet inefficiency, is instances of bunkering delay. And again, this is something that's been evident in the market, particularly at a major bunkering hub such as Singapore, which is at the forefront of the move from high sulfur fuel towards low sulfur fuel. Now, a lot of vessels and owners are making these steps now to transition over. So from about March, from about July of this year, you could see instances of up to 10 days delay being talked about anecdotally at Singapore. And this was a product of preparations being made, mm-hmm. tanks being cleaned, bunker vessels being prepared. And also as well, we can see instances of tank cleaning on specific dry bulk carriers.
Thanks, Derek. I mean, that's really, really interesting. So just to summarize those two points that you're saying first of all, there's a tightening of the vessel supply due to vessels being taken out of service to go into dry dock to be retrofitted with scrubbers, but then also that the switchover of physical bunkering infrastructure, as you say, you know, barge cleaning, storage on land, other infrastructure is also creating delays in bunkering with new low sulfur fuel. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. And in addition to this, it's been a major impact on the market this year in terms of one of the biggest increases we saw in the market is Capesize and Panamax rates. They were mm-hmm. the ones that started to push up most immediately in the third quarter. And you know, this year we've had probably one of the main Capesize flows has been in iron ore. This is one of the key drivers of the Capesize market, Brazilian iron ore, moving into East Asia, most notably China. And with the tragic dam disaster earlier this year and the resulting reduction in iron ore cargo, the impact of IMO 2020 has been even more evident. This is not a year where trade flows have been at their highest, but still we've seen a dramatic increase from July onwards. And that very much points to the IMO 2020 story.
Okay, so I mean, even with the lack of available cargoes, we're still seeing this tightening supply driving rates, as you say.
Absolutely, yes. So this is one factor that's definitely impacting the freight market. The second one I would, of course, point to, and this is if you're looking at any kind of voyages involving a freight rate that involves bunker fuel costs is, of course, mm-hmm. the anticipated effect on the fuel costs. Now, at the moment, as I mentioned, we are on the way. We are moving. We can see vessels being marketed at the moment carrying very low sulfur fuel oil. Already, as we speak, at the end of October, that is the case, and there'll be much more transition by the end of the year. What becomes key then is looking at some of the spreads opening up between the high sulfur fuel oil mm-hmm. and the lower sulfur alternatives, which are more costly. And this is going to be extremely important in terms of the importance, the value of scrubber economics for those owners that have opted to install scrubbers, and also for charterers in terms of how much they would have to pay on a dollar per tonne basis when you're including the bunker fuel costs. This is going to be of key importance for them. Something I can add to that is that we're seeing a bit of a drop at the moment for Supramax, Panamax earnings in the Atlantic.
Okay.
And it's could be demand linked, but at the same time, it may be coincidental, but if you're a ship owner, operator, looking to use high sulfur fuel oil, then really to be given the length of time takes to ballast from the Pacific into the Atlantic and back again, you'd be bunkering in the Pacific, you would have to be either in the Atlantic already or well on the way to take advantage of that. So it may well be that we're seeing more ships in the Atlantic, partly being influenced by the timing of the transition.
That's interesting. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the economics of this change as well. I mean, you mentioned earlier the economics of fitting a scrubber and what the payoff with those could be. So I wanted to get a feeling from you about the differential between the different fuel prices, the low sulfur and the high sulfur, and how you're seeing that at the moment now that we're just 2 months away.
Well, this is a crucial question, and really there's no simple answer because every ship owner has a different ship spec and so on, and different costs of scrubber installation. But of course, the wider the spread between the low sulfur, the 0.5%, and the old high sulfur, that's of course is fairly key. We don't really have a real market at the moment, so that this becomes a question that I want to throw out there and really pose at the moment is what that's going to be. And looking at the Singapore market and comparing the 0.5% sulfur against the high sulfur fuel oil. In the Q3, that spread was $90 per tonne. And by October, it had risen to $165 to $170. So that does seem to indicate that it's moving, certainly as we approach the deadline. We've also had some fairly wide spreads. The 0.1% sulfur that I mentioned earlier, which we have pricing history for, against high sulfur, last week we saw the highest spread for 6 years, so since September 2013. Now in September 2013, the price of crude was over $100 a barrel. Now of course at this level at the moment we're seeing Brent, I think, around as we speak around 60, WTI below that. So that does imply that there's this IMO 2020 effect is starting to be felt. But what we don't have is a complete transition yet.
Okay.
That's what we don't have. So I think one of the questions there is how this is going to price. You're looking at the oil futures markets, as I mentioned, pricing in a fairly smooth transition. Looking at the dry freight market at the moment, and it prices, yes, a discount. It's certainly within the range that we've seen in previous years. These become key questions. Also, as I've talked about, the flow of vessels into the Atlantic as opposed to the Pacific as well, that then becomes a question for the owners and operators. It becomes like in motor racing, like a pit stop strategy. How much do you load? When do you load? The timing becomes important because as we are in late October, as I mentioned, you have to either be there or on the way to have taken a full load of high sulfur fuel oil. So these become really important questions. In terms of for owners and operators, this is a bit of a learning experience. You have to transition across. So some of the tanks in the vessel are going to be used for the low sulfur being phased in, and some won't be. So through all these, it's a massive learning experience for everyone. It's an unprecedented change. It's coming up very soon. And yeah, we've seen disruption, and the question is, to what extent do we see disruption carrying on?
Thanks very much. That's really interesting. I love the pit stop analogy. I think that really helps to focus people's minds on exactly the decisions that ship owners and operators have to make, and charterers, as they go through this change. One of the questions that I had on the pricing and the fuel availability, I mean, And that's the availability of high sulfur fuel oil in the future. So you said possibly 20 to 25% of the Capesize market with scrubbers, 10% in Panamax and less so for the smaller sizes. There will be some demand for high sulfur fuel oil. We talked about the delays of bringing low sulfur into the physical infrastructure. Obviously, you can't mix it in the same tanks, whether on barges, in vessels or ashore. Is there any sort of potential pinch in high sulfur fuel oil supply?
It's a very good question, Richard. And it remains to be seen, really. It's something else I'd draw your attention to is also the underlying price of crude. At the moment, crude, as we mentioned, compared to 2013, we're at relatively low levels. If you get sudden movements in the price of crude, as we did recently, then we saw the high sulfur fuel oil price really spike, get to some very dramatic levels, particularly in Singapore. The premium of Singapore against Rotterdam really jumped to levels that we haven't seen, certainly not this decade, certainly not this century. But there are a lot of variables. And of course, with the oil markets, at times they can be a bit more febrile than they are currently. And that's where I think a lot of the risk comes in.
That's really interesting. And that point you make, especially about the supply in Singapore, I guess with the high-low sulfur spreads where we are at the moment, the economics of moving high sulfur fuel oil east to Singapore probably don't work out the way they have done in the past. And so maybe that market's a little bit more susceptible to price spikes.
Yeah, and across the region, I think we're sort of hearing of issues getting hold of high sulfur fuel oil right across the region there. I've heard Australia, New Zealand. It's certainly not by any means limited to Singapore. So it's a key change. It's a massive change. And we're right in the middle of it at the moment.
Interesting times. I mean, we've talked about high and low sulfur fuel oil. I think it's worth discussing whether there are new fuels out there, whether there's any other options. We hear a lot of discussion now for several years in the market about small scale LNG. Obviously, LNG is a clean fuel. Do we see any change in the bunkering infrastructure? Do we see any initiatives to try and bring LNG into more mainstream shipping markets as a fuel?
Well, without quoting any hard data at this point, we have seen, and I think Derek could probably corroborate this from the dry bulk perspective, an increased interest in dual fuel vessels. This has been particularly pronounced when it comes to tankers. Obviously, LNG is already being in the clear since they burn part of their cargo as fuel. This should be something that gains increasing attention as we go forward. IMO 2020, as we keep saying, is here to stay. And the industry will have to react and find feasible solutions going forward. We have already seen the oil majors, Total and Shell being two good examples, that have already invested in LNG bunkering. And this is also to serve other commodities such as liner vessels or ro-ro vessels. But it's also going forward to serve some of the tanker orders we've seen, Aframaxes, I believe, as well as other classes, that will be employing engines that can burn LNG as a fuel as well. Of course, this is one more category where there are many, many question marks and very few fixed points. But it's definitely an area of interest that we're looking closely at. And more importantly, it's something our clients are asking about and trying to see what they will do going forward with their own portfolios.
Thanks, Philip. I think that point about LNG bunkering infrastructure and the different vessel types that it might serve is really interesting. You know, so what are the limitations of deploying LNG bunkering infrastructure more globally? You said the lead points are in Northwest Europe, a little bit in Singapore at the moment, but obviously it would have to become more widespread to be a more widely used fuel. What are the difficulties in achieving that?
I think it's the first that come to mind, really, when it comes to transitioning to a different fuel. It's supply availability, it's logistics storage capacity, it's continued demand and the flow of off-takers. It's the entire logistics conundrum, and particularly with LNG, storage is a big question mark because essentially to keep it chilled, to keep it liquid, it has to be at negative 163 degrees. And this poses an issue when trying to store it long-termly, as you do lose some of it to boil off, due to, obviously, the laws of physics and currently imperfect containment systems.
Well, thanks, guys. I mean, it's really interesting to hear about how this transition is affecting the different markets. It would be great, I mean, Duncan, it would be wonderful to understand how we see this affecting the paper markets that, of course, are, you know, inextricably linked to all of the physical transition that we've been hearing about.
Well, I think the overriding point to make about the impact of all of this on the derivative markets is that it's been positive, but it would be very hard to pin a tail on the donkey of exactly where the positive effect can be shown. I think an interesting example would be if you look at the dry FFA market back in 2018. We saw a slight anomaly in that the second year futures contracts for the dry bulk FFA market were higher in volume traded than the first year. So as long ago as 2 years back, we saw people preparing and taking FFA positions for 2020 higher than the volume of trading for the next year.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that is interesting, and one can draw some conclusions for that. But the dry FFA market, like the tanker market, has always been very much a prompt market, with the majority of the volume focused in the front few months. So although an interesting anomaly, not a major mover. I think the way to look at these markets is that the backdrop of the dry bulk FFA market is that, like all other markets, it got a pretty hard knock from the credit crunch of 2008-2009, and had the stuffing kicked out of it. 50% of that stuffing had been over the counter, went over to cleared, and by around 2013, it really had bottomed out, and we were seeing around 200,000 lots trading a quarter at the sort of low points in the market.
Okay.
And since then, there's been a build-up, taking the market noise out. There's been a long, slow build-up to around 300,000 lots a quarter, that ran about 100,000 lots a month, 25,000 a week. And in the last year, we've seen two quarters when we've had very nearly 400,000 lots trading. So we've doubled from low to high, and we've seen strong trend growth in the dry market over the last 5 or 6 years. And certainly, I think that the contributing volatilities from uncertainty over 2020 will have contributed to that. And certainly, the dry FFA market participants really engaged very strongly with their colleagues in the physical market in the whole debate. So it's clear that physical market participants were using the derivatives market the way we'd like to see them doing it. On the other hand, when we look at the tanker market, in the last year or two, we've seen that double. And the FFA markets have ever been markets of capacity. Mm-hmm. Where the participants see volatility, then they'll reach for the FFA market and the volume will spike. And so we've seen quarterly volume for the tanker FFA market in the last year go from a pretty depressing 60,000 lots up to around 120. So we doubled, and getting to around 10,000 lots a week. So what does that tell us about what we might see in the LNG FFA market? You know, we've heard a lot of comments so far qualified with the it's impossible to tell for certain, but clearly leading the way, we have the Baltic Exchange with their three new LNG time charter contracts, and there have been signals from the market as the occasional over-the-counter trades have been broke, settling against those, that the market is enthusiastic for the derivative risk management tool to get launched on a clear basis in LNG. And then we can look at the underlying growth, particularly in the JKM market, which mm-hmm. everyone talks about on these occasions. Japan, Korea, LNG pricing, and we've seen that market, that derivative market, grow by around 10 times in the last year or so, and there is now a healthy volume of trade going on in JKM derivatives, and we think that that could certainly support an initial 10 or 20,000 lot a week market for LNG. So really the LNG market could be bursting onto the scene in a similar size to the current tanker FFA market, and then there is scope for continued growth.
Thanks, that's really interesting. So to make sure I understand correctly, you're saying, you know, on the dry side, we've seen continued growth for a number of years now, and then I think you said people reaching for derivatives when there's uncertainty, which is a really, I think, key point, that you said the physical players are using these tools for risk management in these volatile times against the backdrop of the market growing anyway. So I think that's interesting. And then seeing the same thing in the tanker market, you're saying really then that the market is ripe for shipping derivatives as a whole, and with the growth in the JKM, LNG FFAs could very well be next.
Exactly. And really the reason for this is very straightforward. When you look at the underlying physical market, it's very different to the derivative market. The underlying market has very large transactions which happen relatively infrequently. Mm-hmm. And the obvious risk mitigation tool, an opportunity when you're exposed to that sort of pricing, is to go into relatively smaller trades more frequently. In other words, you use derivatives to adjust your exposure to the very risky, very large underlying physical market. And it's already the case that there is a groundswell of interest in this, not just amongst the opportunist brokers and exchanges and derivatives businesses, but also in the underlying owners and operators of the infrastructure of LNG transportation.
Okay, so you see real demand from the physical market, as you say, not necessarily just the financial side of the business, but the people that are going to drive the volume with managing their risk.
Yes, and this is certainly a story which has been borne out by our experience in the tanker, and particularly in the dry market. These are very much trade-based markets. They've built up with participants with exposure to the underlying commodity, to the underlying physical freight market. Mm-hmm. And certainly along the way, they've been greatly assisted by the financial participants. And over the years in dry, we've seen a fall-off in bank activity, but at the same time, we've seen a lifting interest from the natural investors into the freight market, the funds, private equity, and so forth. And so the same opportunity for engagement exists in LNG. We're relatively confident that this will be a successful derivative launch. And it's certainly something that SSY Futures will be interested in getting behind. In some respects, over the years, we've turned from a one-trick pony who've always focused very much on the FFA market. We've branched out into the bulk commodity markets, and we've developed expertise in listing, new products and mm-hmm. growing new markets. And so really that is now the opportunity for us is to commit our expertise and resources to the growth of the LNG freight market.
Fantastic. Clearly you're a big supporter. I mean, it's interesting to think when we talk about this market as well, we know that the underlying shipping market in LNG is relatively small if we compare it to dry bulk and to tankers. The spot market trades relatively infrequently with a lot of LNG business still being based on longer term contracts. So does the application of that product go beyond the pure shipping market to the LNG traders as well?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I have to be very careful on these occasions not to talk over my colleagues in the research market, because here I am, a generalist, and they're sitting around the table with genuine expertise in this area. But we anticipate that the core success of the LNG derivatives market has been the opportunity to trade price differentials around hubs.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that the freight market in LNG and freight derivatives in LNG will naturally fit into that and afford great opportunities for participants in those markets.
Okay, so we're talking about a TTF, Henry Hub, JKM plus LNG freight as forming a real tradable sort of ecosystem.
Exactly, a virtuous circle.
So the LNG FFA market is really right at its inception right now, and we're seeing a number of businesses come to market trying to put a benchmark out there. Do you think that's a good thing for the industry to have competing businesses, and what do you think it says about this market in general?
Well, I think you pose an excellent question, and one we have been asked and we have asked ourselves. Fundamentally, the LNG FFA is crucially important into increasing the liquidity of spot trading, both on the cargo side and the freight side. Traders, portfolio players, everybody needs it. It's unfathomable that you are not in a position currently to hedge your freight exposure, especially when the freight element can be anywhere between 2 to 20% of delivered cargo value. When rates are super high, you could be losing millions on freight. Having said that, having various providers at the moment competing against each other for who will come out on top as the industry benchmark upon which the FFA contracts will be based is very healthy for the industry, we find.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately what you want is a robust index, a commonly accepted index, that will be used by more and more people and eventually invite speculators and banks and increase the total liquidity. The more counterparties you have, the better you can hedge your freight position and exposure. So I think the market will ultimately decide which benchmark will be the one used.
Mm-hmm.
The ones we collaborate and interact with, we believe in their approach, but ultimately it's our clients that will decide which one will be used going forward. And it's not a race, I guess, in which more than one horse wins. I feel that's my personal opinion on the matter.
So it's interesting that you said that the competition sort of helps all of those providers actually to deliver a better benchmark. And as you say, at the end of the day, it's the people with the risk who are trading these products that need to have certainty and faith in that benchmark to make the market work.
Exactly. There has to be confidence that is the benchmark that best represents where the market is and where the market will be as it's viewed by the various players. And fundamentally, all you need is more than one person to do business with. You can't do business by yourself. You need a counterparty. And when you have a robust benchmark, you have more counterparties that are willing to use that and trade on it.
Thanks. Philip, the other thing that you said, which I thought was really interesting, was this hint at the symbiotic relationship or the virtuous circle of being able to manage the freight exposure and how that can drive an increase in spot LNG trading as well, as if the two are sort of linked. And you made an analogy to the oil market and said if we look at the volume of derivatives to physical in the oil market, we see that derivatives vastly exceed the physical market. LNG is still a very long way from that point as a relatively nascent commodity still. But it's interesting to think that the shipping side can help the spot commodity trading as well.
Absolutely. I think that's what we're seeing, is that as we transition into a market where you can eventually fully or at least partially hedge your freight exposure, you will have more people getting into the trading of the physical cargoes as well, which was until previously the privilege of companies that had their own freight. Mm-hmm. Based on the fact that traditionally LNG contracts were point A to point B with destination clauses, you couldn't divert a cargo, you couldn't sell it elsewhere, you couldn't optimize your trading portfolio. Going forward, it's one more weapon that traders and portfolio players can utilize to make their trading more efficient, is hedging their freight.
Philip, obviously volatility in LNG freight rates is nothing new, but has the recent volatility with the background of people talking about LNG FFAs, has that helped to move the LNG FFA conversation forwards?
Absolutely. I think it's been a driving force, especially since the winter of 2017 to 2018. And then Q4 2018, and then this year as well, we've seen such volatility where market players essentially have taken pause and said, we can no longer be exposed to such a freight volatility. We have to do something about it as an industry. And we've actually had several clients who are really actively asking and pushing and following up on it. And as brokers, we are working together with a few of the providers that are currently in the race to be the benchmark. And I think this, as you said, is on the back of the volatility we've seen. And volatility isn't going anywhere in the future. What can happen is we can have a more robust tool to hedge this volatility. And I think it will serve each and every player in the market and hopefully attract more players.
Thanks very much. Probably the one element of constant in the shipping market, continued volatility, you'd say, right? We've been talking about different fuels. We've been talking about the differential in price between low sulfur, ultra low sulfur, high sulfur fuels. We talked a little bit about how LNG could be an alternative fuel and the change in the bunker infrastructure. It'd be great to understand a little bit about the pricing of LNG as a potential bunker fuel.
That's actually a question we've been asking ourselves, because it is quite opaque at the moment. What we can say is that LNG infrastructure is very costly. Even the smallest of bunkering vessels could cost $20, $30, $40, $50 million to build. LNG capacity, storage capacity, and regasification. Everything along the LNG supply chain is very capital intensive. And when you have bunkering where you have smaller parcels, you lose the advantage of economies of scale, which is something that fundamentally has benefited LNG carriers, is the fact that when you liquefy the gas, it becomes 600 times smaller and you can carry a vast amount overseas. The floating pipeline we referred to on these $200 million assets. However, when you're speaking about bunkering, you have to have that critical volume of demand that will slowly enable these economies of scale in terms of supply, and will make the entire supply chain work. And how long that takes, I guess it depends on how quickly and aggressively the first movers deal with this, such as some of the portfolio players I mentioned earlier, who are already making a transition and have LNG bunkering vessels on order, or on the water, actually, in the case of Shell and Total. It should be interesting. It's definitely necessary to have another alternative. and LNG and natural gas are in abundance, and they're clean burning. So I think the value proposition is definitely there. We just have to make it work.
It's interesting what you say about, you know, being a first mover in LNG bunkering with the capital intensity of setting up that supply chain. We talked a little bit earlier about how some of the other vessel types may be easier to start LNG bunkering. Do you think they could sort of help bunker suppliers? If you have a distribution network which you know is going to provide a certain amount of volume, does that enable you to take the next step and then provide a more distributed network which transshippers could take advantage of?
I think definitely. I think that type of approach is along the right lines. And this is by no means my segment or facet of expertise, but I think it goes without saying that the moment you can eliminate having a vast amount of variables and you at least have some fixed points where you know you're going to have LNG storage capacity and you know you're going to have 1, 2, 5, 10 LNG bunkering vessels, and you start building out this network, the next person that comes in, the entry barriers are that much lower. So eventually, when you increase the number of players that come in and you decrease the variables and you have more fixed points to make financial decisions upon, I think we should see also an acceleration of the transition. So we all in the industry, I feel, remain hopeful that LNG as a bunker will be the future.
Well, guys, thank you all very much. It was certainly interesting from my side.
Thanks,
Richard.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
I hope everyone listening found that as interesting as I did in the room here. As always, if you have any questions, please feel free to contact us. My email address is richard.heath@eex.com, and stay tuned for our next episode next month.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.